To me, it sounds like we have a narrative forming here. There is a young little Kari. He actually has a real passion for it. He makes hundreds of episodes of game reviews and whatnots. 100, 200, 300 projects. Then finally, you know, the gates of heaven open. Everything is possible. And all of a sudden, then you lose the passion. Why at that point it didn't click for you?
It's pleasant to be back, Henrik, but it's less pleasant to go back the memory lane, Henrik.
Yeah, well, I take zero responsibility for today's topic.
Yeah, so this is something different again. Surprise, surprise. This week's experiment involves us discussing our history and experience with technology related to video and audio production. All the hurdles around it, what are our careers in this field, if there's any to speak of, we'll find out all of that in this episode. Hope it's fun for our listeners, you know, everybody knows like all those lovely analog technologies we used to have, and we'll share our thoughts on that in this memory lane.
If nothing else, I believe it will be fun for me. I can't say anything for you, Kari, but...
Not sure. I don't know who's interviewing who here, but...
God is interviewing all of us.
There you have it.
Uh-huh.
Speaking of that, how did you actually get involved with anything audiovisual?
Kind of purely and simply as an accident. To be honest, I don't really remember when I first time got involved with audiovisual. Per se, like when I originally tipped my toes into those waters, the moment when I did it like academically, when I finally applied to actually study the bloody field, that was mostly just a happy accident. I applied as a half as a joke, and then when the entrance exams were, I just happened to be around. Just a twist of fate, and I just didn't have anything better to do at that day. So I decided to actually participate in the bloody entrance exams, and well, that led into the academic fields. When it comes to working as a professional, well, once I started to study the audio visuals, then the next big question obviously became like, how can I get work from this field? Having the past bachelor in business, what kind of led me into a dead end when I graduated from business side. The layoffs were all around Finland, so that was kind of being bachelor in business administration meant that there was at the time there was no jobs for you at all.
Weird.
So it's kind of like, where will you just save yourself in that moment? I saved myself to the audio visuals, and then from studying audio visual, the obvious question was like, how you're gonna land a job here. And that also to me happened pretty much by accident. Like my first gigs on the field were just an accident.
Do you consider yourself like a professional, Henrik? What's like the threshold you have to pass to consider yourself a professional? When are you a professional?
I don't consider myself a professional.
Okay.
But then again, I'm notoriously bad when it comes to somehow applying status or symbols to myself. I always give them to others and say that others are professional, but I never see the professional in me personally.
That's very sweet.
And I don't think there ever will be a threshold that I can get over so that I would truly feel that I am a professional. Take this podcast, for example. We have been doing this for over 5 years now. And I still don't feel myself as a professional podcaster.
No.
And it's not a question of the product. I'm extremely proud of the product that we have provided, the Flick Lab. It's not question about the money. I don't know, perhaps it could be a question of... Nah, it wouldn't be a question of money either. Like, if I would get a regular monthly paycheck from podcasting, I still don't believe that I would actually consider myself as a professional podcaster. Because I don't also consider myself as a professional film crew member or anything else.
Professionality. I guess that's officially considered when you have graduated and then you work in the field. You are still not, you still haven't graduated, but you're very close there.
Well, I don't know about close, to be honest.
Okay.
It's kind of a mess, mostly because work and everything else comes into a way.
So, yeah, that's kind of ironic in a way. Working in the field and can't finish your studies. Let's say like a year or a little over a year, you think?
Yeah, a little over a year, yeah.
Yeah. I've been thinking about the whole money thing as well. Money in itself doesn't really make you a professional, does it? It gives you more responsibilities. You might have to give up some of your freedom with this podcast. So I've been thinking about that. If the opportunity would hit you, would you go for it? Would I go for it? Certainly some benefits. You are kind of forced. Your hand is forced to deliver a product every 2 weeks or whatever the case would be then. And there would be someone, you know, I guess appreciating your work because you would be doing it for the money. So there's that. But also then the pressure would multiply, like, I don't know, tenfold. And you would have to deliver. You would have to deliver on time. And I guess it would mean also that you have to deliver a certain kind of product. So you have less reasons to follow your interest, which is ironic because the listeners would come from the previous episodes that you have put out, which would be coming from your understanding of how you want to deliver this product. So a certain level of streamlining would come as a necessity. So it's interesting.
Yeah, a certain kind of product, I would say, would be for me the biggest question doing podcasting for money. Like when it comes to pressure, when it comes to timetables, when it comes to the need to actually have a level of quality, that I would say pretty much has stayed consistent throughout the 5 years that we have done this.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say that having a paycheck, let's say, for example, for doing the Flick Lab, would that much... I don't think it would put more pressure on me, because we already are in the point where we have to deliver every 2 weeks, and we stress about that. We stress about the quality of each recording session. We stress about the quality of the cutting and the episodes. We stress about the background research work that we do for not this episode, but every other episode. So the stress already is there, and the quality also already exists there, as does the timetable. So what I would believe would be the thing that we would mostly have to sacrifice would be kind of the interest and the topics that we tackle in each episode, because at that moment, would somebody actually, would we do this for money? Would we do this for some media agency or something like that? In that case, the demands of what type of episodes and the structure of the said episodes would come from, the demands for the episode and what type of episode we would have to do would basically come from the direction of whoever is paying the paycheck.
Do you have any regrets of applying to study this field? And what's actually what you're studying now, if you want to share again to our listeners?
Well, at the moment, I always regret basically everything that I do, be it good or bad. Especially I regret every choice that I've ever made when it comes to studying.
Oh, I kind of have the same feeling. I had a kind of severe crisis of myself. I'm now kind of hijacking, I guess, wherever you might have been going with your discussion there, but I remember that when you needed to select your next field of studies, well, it was the end of the primary school, and I was forced to kind of decide when I was, 14, 15, what is the future of me gonna look like? this has been discussed on media lately somewhere. I've been reading some articles related to this, that it's way too early for a person to decide on the rest of their life, basically. Well, fortunately, and especially at the time in Finland, it wasn't like at the end of life decision, because you could study as many times you wanted. You could go have another degree on the vocational field, or go into another university, study some other field, Uni of Applied Sciences. But I was told that I need to go study printing, industrial printing, because I'm not even sure anymore what was the situation. Like, there wasn't enough seats to go study audiovisual, which was definitely my number one, and there was nothing else even in my horizon whatsoever. So I just had to choose something. I went to study industrial printing. I did later kind of realize that, you know, these are very integrally linked. Both are dealing with media, and you need kind of similar application knowledge. Both support each other. But I didn't appreciate it at the time very much. And after 1 year, I finally got my place in audiovisual studies, and I went to a different school and started studying that. So that's kind of how it started. But I believe I spent like, what, freaking 7 years, was it, with just the audiovisual studies. That took some doing. I had different projects going on. I was dealing with, I guess, what would have been diagnosed as some kind of depression or period. So, yeah. After a while, the government started to kind of get more nosy about how you're entitled to your government support for your study money. So you really needed to start learning at some point and go to the classes, which I didn't. Then I went to the army. Then, funnily enough, I went to and finished my printing studies. And then I went to audiovisual again to finish that in a different city. It's been a mess. But yeah, I do remember my grandfather giving me a very wise point when I was not feeling really good about having been half forced into this printing school. He told me that what anyone would say, I guess, but it just kind of hit me that no learning is lost, really. All kinds of learning is useful. You'll see. And yeah, he was right. But still, at the time, as like a 20-something, as like 16-year-old person, you don't really appreciate that. And you don't really believe in that.
That actually sounds pretty typical Finnish story. I do think, believe that that's a also quite universal story, but yeah, especially typical Finnish story. It's extremely hard, if not nigh impossible, to say when you are a teenager, like, what you want to do for the rest of your life. I mean, adults don't know that either, so how could a teenager or a kid know, like, what he or she wants to do?
Yeah, I think in your family also there wasn't anyone particularly interested in the art field, but it's just the two of us weirdos. Also, in my side, there was no really artists per se in the family, but I was the one interested in this kind of thing.
There is one far removed artist in my mother's side.
Okay.
But I have to say that I know so little about my family background that, and when it comes to the artists in my bloodlines, they are so quite unknown and usually just, you know, artists for hobby level, so that there really is not much information that I've ever been able to gather about the subject.
Right. Yeah, there. So it's kind of funny that I then found my way into this. No one was there to guide me to the right direction, but they gave me the tools for some reason, anyway, to find my way into this. So since a very young age, I've been interested in recording things. When I was 3, my mom, I was recording me with her speaking on a C cassette. Yeah, and then a couple of years later, I guess at age 6, I had my own cassette player and loved recording almost anything with it. Anywhere we went, there was a portable cassette player with batteries, and off you go. And then when I was 12, I got my own video camera as a birthday gift from grandma. That's where it kind of escalated.
So why recording? Why was recording the thing that you loved the most?
That's a good question. Capturing moments. The ability to kind of manipulate reality, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. Anything particular in reality that had to be manipulated in your childhood?
Well, I remember doing these audio stories, so to speak. Most of what we did were some kind of action bits with my friend or a couple of friends. Like we would imitate the elements from James Bond movies or whatever action movie it was, and you would pretend to be on top of a train or be in a life and death situation, so facing lava and being on bridges fighting for your life. And you know, it was easy to manipulate that in a way because there wasn't picture yet involved. Yeah, kids, you know, I don't know. That's how it started anyway. Actually, it started at school. The very first recordings that I ever did kind of with my friends, where everything, this kind of artistic side of things started. It was at school. There was a football game. Me and my friend just felt like we had to be like the game commentators there. And then maybe the next day I brought my audio cassette player there and we actually recorded that. We love to perform like that.
Okay, but it never actually, if I understood correctly, it never actually, your love for performance and performing never, like outside of your YouTube channel, it never actually brought you the other side of the camera. You always stayed behind it.
Most of the time, yeah. I've never been so keen on seeing myself in front of camera. I always felt a little disgusted about seeing myself there.
Okay, why is that? I mean, I can kind of already guess a possible answer for the question of why, but if you open it up, like, why disgusted?
Well, the person that I saw in front of the camera was something completely different to what I saw myself as being. It was not really about voice. I never had a problem with voice. A lot of people have concerns about their voice when they see a recording of themselves. Not my case at all. But seeing just the face and the expressions, and I felt like I looked like a complete idiot, so I didn't want any of that.
Okay, so some type of aspect of a body shame.
Yeah, I guess that's what you call it these days. But yeah, Henrik, any memories about C cassettes?
I never toyed with them too much. Like when I was like the last days of my childhood when C cassettes still were even around. They were pretty quickly lost technology once the CDs came about. So I can't really say that I that much ever actually experienced with C cassettes. There were some more or less illegal bootleg recordings of CDs and other C cassettes that I did make. But since I never actually, I never had that I wanna record reality aspect with me. And I never did recordings unless I had to. So therefore, when it came to C cassette technology, I mostly just passed it.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. That was like those analog technologies can be quite scary sometimes. I remember there were a couple of tapes that I had, and I had no idea how there were these kind of sound bits that there were. Obviously, something went wrong with the recording process, but after some normal sounding bit where someone was speaking, then there's finally something like this.
Yeah, for me, when it comes to analog, my love for analog technologies and analog media, it's something that started to develop in me. Well, obviously, the main reason, the main culprit for that would be the VHS technology, which was something that I did experience quite a lot in my childhood.
Yeah.
Because DVDs came about a hell of a lot later than what, you know, CD technology came out came about. But when it comes to like professional love for analog and the possibilities of analog, basically all the weirdness and the scariness that you described, that's something that I really got mixed in with, I would say, like maybe 10 years ago, when I really started to look like, well, outwardly is a wrong word here to use here, but outwardly aspects of analog technologies.
Did you ever have your own video camera around those times?
No, never. Those were way too expensive so that my family would have ever purchased one, especially seeing how, well, none of us were a filmmaker in our childhood. And my parents, they sure as hell were not the holiday home movie type of people.
Right. Yeah, I didn't film my family so much, regrettably, I guess. But actually, I had a lot of fears about who I was filming. I avoided filming faces actively in those early stages. I really don't know why. But yeah, I was scared of if there would be some kind of retribution if someone doesn't want to be filmed. People were a little more tense about that kind of things back in the day, especially in public arenas. I was kind of careful about that.
Okay, I would have believed that people are more tense about being filmed today, since the possibilities and the venues where being filmed can eventually lead you in today's world.
Maybe. On the other hand, people are kind of more used to it, I feel. Because there's a camera at every corner, then, you know, it's not a big deal anymore. 20 years ago, if you walked into a supermarket, if you walked into a shopping mall, there would be guards in 5 minutes telling you to get the hell out because you would be, you know, blamed for some kind of industrial espionage right out of the gate. But now everyone does it. Anyway, I got my first video camera around 11 or 12. That was some Sanyo brand. It made a horrible noise. And there was an increasing picture quality issue. So pretty quickly after that, somehow, I got a brand new Sony CCD-TR-511E, which was kind of nice at the time, using also the Video 8 tapes. So I kind of skipped all that VHS nonsense when it comes into video cameras. So those tapes had actually pretty decent picture quality for those days. And yeah, that's where the hobby horse really got wild. I had especially one friend at the time. I still do consider him my best friend, although we haven't been in touch for 14 years because he mysteriously just stopped being in touch, unfortunately. I wish that would be somehow resolved, but that guy was, in retrospect, I have to say that guy was some kind of a genius. He always had the most inventive ideas. He had an exceptionally large vocabulary, and he was just really quick in every sense of the word. So he was kind of the star of many of those tapes and the kind of acted pieces that we did. Another big thing, of course, was the kind of video game tapes that we did, like playthrough videos. I guess we were kind of early on that. Internet is crazy about that kind of thing, but yeah, we were doing it like it's nobody's business in 1998. Yeah, one of the big parts was that with a group of friends, we did this, I think it was exactly 100 episodes of these game review shows that were never released anywhere. But we kind of did them for our own entertainment. And, you know, they were inspired by this old cable TV called Moon TV. We kind of did our own spin of those. In the process of that, we also did some interviews. In some of those, also Henrik was involved when we went to the Game World events. And I had this kind of analog editing box. You could connect different analog devices to it and then control the volume and have some very rudimentary fade in, fade out, and picture effects, and three or four different channels that you could change on the fly while recording. It was kind of neat. Then, of course, I found digital editing and was kind of done with all that analog nonsense.
Also, what I've understood, pretty much filming all together.
Filming all together.
Yeah. I mean, what have you filmed, let's say, recently? Or
nothing.
To give a generous advantage, since the start of the digital age. You just told me how much you used to film during the analog days.
Mm.
100 episodes of you know, video game reviews, Let's Plays, interviews, your own personal passion projects and everyday life. But since, you know, you left analog and, well, world at large left analog behind and turned into digital, how much have you actually filmed?
Unfortunately, not as much as I would have liked. I started digital editing kind of almost immediately when the stable first version of Adobe Premiere came out, 2001, 2002, something like that. That was quite rudimentary times. It kept crashing all the time. But yeah, that was the start. And of course, as you know, then I did this little hobby project movie, Terminator 2X, kind of like a parody, comedy, something, remake of Terminator 2 with no budget at all. And after that, things stagnated a bit in the sense that in my immediate circles, it was really hard to convince people to join into some kind of new project because they knew that it would take a hell of a lot of time, a hell of a lot of effort to organize everything and always take more time than you would schedule, obviously. But so I stuck to some, you know, small scale things. Again, these kind of video game playthroughs with commentary with a bunch of friends, that kind of things. Those are relatively simple to put together as long as you make interesting playthrough content, of course. After that, pretty much I went back to the audiovisual studies and now I had access to the studio that they have at the school. So, yeah. That was fun. We shot a music video, did some experimental, dreamlike short films that I unfortunately don't have anymore. Like, nothing fancy or anything. Filmed with SD cameras, as far as I remember. That was really the stage when it was starting to switch from SD to HD. But around the same time, I started working as like a trainee for one company that is known for many famous TV series in Finland, kind of reality TV mostly, at the time anyway. And so, yeah, that opened the doors for more HD content or experimenting with HD shooting. What I did for that company, well, it was really just kind of B-roll footage for those reality type of shows, assisting editing, going through the hours and hours of material that we shot, color grading at the later stages. After that, I was kind of done. I was kind of done with the field. I felt like I didn't have much passion for anything anymore at that point.
Okay, because to me it sounds like we have a narrative forming here. Not a big narrative necessarily, but you know, a small one. There is a young little Kari, he's toying with all this shit-tier analog technologies, but he actually has a real passion for it. He makes hundreds of episodes of game reviews and whatnots. 100, 200, 300 projects using analog technology. And then finally, you know, the gates of heaven open. You get access to the digital technology where everything is possible. No longer just, you know, limited to 4 voice channels. Now you can have 12, 16 voice channels. You can have all these voice channels and you don't have to anymore mess with analog tapes yourself, let alone, you know, do any analogical editing. You can just edit digitally and you can shoot on SD cards. Basically, everything is digital, everything is possible, and all of a sudden, you make a handful of projects and then you lose the passion.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know. When you don't have those type of friends around you that would be interested in the same type of things, then at some point it just dies that passion. Like, okay, nobody wants to do fuck all. So that's the end of the road. Of course, yes, I could have been more looking for some partners online who are interested in similar activities. Yes, in school, I had a lot of friends who had like wonderful minds and they were interested in all sorts of things. Some things came out of those things. We went for a lot of location scouting, had a lot of plans, some rudimentary scripts, but very little actionable items at the end of the day. And also those friends were left in the city of Lohja. Then I moved to another city, to Oulu. Life changed again, so this is just how it goes. Then you need to make ends meet. Actually, I was in Oulu for about a year, unemployed, just trying to get some work from my field. Trying to, you know, keep this thing going. Then no one gives a shit. And Kari is like, all right, let's sell telephones, as we say in Finland. And I went to a call center and all kinds of different endeavors. Not so fanciful.
But didn't those two things, basically, that the passion and the possibility to make the ends meet, didn't they both meet during the time when you were actually working on professionally on reality, etc.? Like, you know, you would think, like, obviously, you know, staying in that field, staying with the company could have led into you being actually being able to pay your rent and buy some food.
Mm.
Having an actual paycheck, making the ends meet, so to speak. And one would believe that a professional production company would also have the passion for the projects and the field that they are working on. So why at that point it didn't click for you? Because to me it sounds like that is the point when you finally decided to walk away from the field.
I think there are so many things. One thing was that it's always per project in this field, almost always. You sign up for one project for a couple of months, there's always a really hectic deadline breathing down your face and your neck. And, you know, you don't really have much of artistic freedom in those jobs that I used to do. You would have to be, you know, at least an editor or maybe a director to feel like you are really contributing something of your own. Okay, yeah, I actually did do a couple of those advertisements for TV1 or TV2 related to some of those TV series, which was cool, yeah. I was able to just decide on my own which kind of pieces to use and in which order and what kind of vibes and all. So they just send it to the channel. Okay, that's it. Cool. So that was nice, but that's about as far as I ever got to, you know, contributing something. I don't know, I just feel it was a passion thing to be shooting something. Once you're in a company, then they tell you the rules of what to do. And that's when the passion kind of withers and dies.
Okay, so you need the artistic freedom in for yourself in order to actually be able to enjoy what you are doing.
Yeah.
Because harking back to our today's discussion, it's also a point that you raised up when we were talking about the possibility to ever take the Flick Lab and make this a payable project for us, something that we could mm-hmm. cash in. And one of our kind of a shared notion for both of us there was that, you know, if this would ever be like work for paycheck kind of situation, we would automatically lose the artistic control on what mm-hmm. we would do and how we would actually make any current episode.
Yeah, that's right. And let's just say that the more I've done this podcast, in a way, the less I feel passionate towards movies. Or maybe I'm just feeling some kind of, maybe I'm just tired of content, which we have been discussing in past episodes. Maybe I'm just permanently tired of also this wannabe art and pretentiousness in films and egos behind the projects, egos what I've seen. I'm tired of commercial content, that's for sure. And when you've reached a certain kind of threshold with movies, once you've seen enough of movies, a certain number anyway, you kind of become allergically sensitive to content that you can completely now see through. You can see what it's trying to do. to cover its bases, why it's doing the things that it's doing, money over substance. And when that happens, I just turn off the TV. I don't fucking care anymore. If you've got nothing to say and you just want me to be glued on the screen with these little tactics of yours, if there's no intellectual or some kind of artistic value behind all of that, or some, I don't know, revolutionary message, most likely I just turn it off. I don't care. I don't care.
The so-called and the Oscar for Best Picture goes to problem.
Ditto, my friend.
Yeah.
And same goes for music and TV shows. Any kind of arts of audiovisual type that I can think of. Got nothing to say? Okay. I won't watch it. You know, when I was working for those couple of projects for this company, I saw a lot of different strong characters. Maybe someone's gonna burn me alive for saying this, but yeah, hi everyone. Nice working with you. But yeah, there are a lot of big egos in this business. And when you enter a company that young, well, everybody's young there, but there is always, you've really strongly feel that competition also going on. There's some other 17, 18, 19 something guy coming in. He's telling you all about his experiences. Yeah, I was filming this. Yeah, I was filming that, you know. And they speak of it with such pride, and why wouldn't they? It's just that, yeah, there's always this internal fight going on, who kind of gets to have projects, who people want to show off, is what I'm saying. And if you're older, then, and if you're in a higher position than a trainee or somebody who was recently hired like me, then they would be really, let's just say that they would not appreciate what you were doing. They always had a seed of doubt in them that this guy is not going to finish on time. This guy doesn't understand what the fuck I'm talking about. This guy is going to do it all wrong. And it's just those kind of negative attitudes that turned me off. And the pressure. And the deadlines. And you have 2 months to do this and then you're unemployed again. Yay.
Yeah. Like, the media field, hands down, is perhaps one of the most ego-driven fields that you have to be working on. Well, I don't know, perhaps outside of banking, or, you know, economic finances.
Mm.
That might be even more ego-driven, but yeah, media world, especially, highly, highly ego-driven, big egos all around.
Yeah.
It's kind of it's sad in the sense that it's also a field that forces you to be ego-driven. Since, like you mentioned, the whole field is essentially it's gig-based. You have to always land on the next job. You have to get the next gig, so to say, and you have to get them quite quickly because gig lasts something like from 2 days to 2 months, let's say. And you have 12 months a year, so you have to kind of line up the next gig while you are working on the previous one. So, and in order to be able to be chosen for the next one, you have to really push yourself out there. You have to be one of those guys who constantly goes about how I was shooting this and we were shooting that and I was there and shooting the shit. So and that's like you have to do that in order to stay on afloat in the business.
Yeah.
Which of course, once again, it kind of magnifies your own ego. It's not just that everyone on the field believes that they are the next big artist, they are the next Spielberg or what have you, hotshot cinematographer, but it's also that they have to believe that, or at least they have to act like that in order to be marketable for the next job, to be chosen for the next project. And that's kind of one of the biggest downsides and one of the most harmful sides of media fields. And also the reason why I find it ever so more difficult to actually recommend media field as a as a, you know, field of work for other people, because you don't feel it at first. You don't feel it in your first two gigs. The kind of, like you said, the constant internal competition, and also the effect of everybody pushing you down, kind of because they have to, because they have to lift themselves up in order to once again be marketable for the next job. You don't necessarily feel it for the first two times when you are working on a gig, but when you are landing your 10th gig, then you know, those experiences, that the mileage, they slowly start to feel on you. And if you are really young, like most on the field are, since they go to study the field as quickly as possible, they graduate as quickly as possible, and then they try to land the first job opportunity as quickly as possible, so they are somewhere, you know, 25 to 30 when they start to work on the field, they are still relatively young. So yeah, I would say that it's a hell of a field to actually, especially to enter if you are a young person.
Yeah. What about you? You know, we're both starting to get a little older, and a lot of the base of those projects, I would imagine, are where there are some old hawks there as well. But you know, these young, I don't know, wannabes are people who keep telling how excellent they are, or what they've experienced, or listening to their suggestions on how to run this project. Don't you get tired?
And not really. Not me personally. But something that most likely helps me here is my previous bachelor in business. Hmm. Because, oh boy, if we weren't like driven by high egos when we were studying that field, that was even more toxic and more kind of a downgrading than what the media field is, or that at least has been my experience comparing the two fields together. Because oh shit, if we like back in business, we were the next level of Gordon Gekko-esque assholes. We're not quite as bad, but there was a certain type of field, and also us being young assholes, driven, well not need and not mandate, but some type of a drive that kind of just pushed us forward into that direction, to becoming more and more Gordon Gekko-esque. And coming from that experience and being able to look back on that, it kind of also gives me some, I don't know, levity or easygoingness when it comes to now having the hungry first-timers pushing their own artistic egos and telling you how and what type of a shot they want, etc., etc. It kind of makes it, I believe that the business experience makes it easier for me to just, you know, go with it.
Yeah.
Just be like, okay, fine, you know, you want this. I know it's not gonna work. I can tell you already that it's not gonna be what you believe it's going to be. But, you know, if you say that that's what you want, you're not gonna get, fix it in post.
So, interestingly enough, it turns out that you are actually now the one out of us two that actually has some kind of career to speak of. Do you think is it kind of, well, I guess I should ask myself this question, but yeah, Kari, was it pathetic that you just decided to kind of abandon this field altogether when you did? It wasn't like it just happened just like that overnight. It was just a lot of things, you know, moving to another city, doing all kinds of things just to survive. Then after that, I guess just there started looming all the possibilities of working outside of the country and how much money you could make with that compared to, you know, Poland is, at least was, like a cheap country at the time, and the salaries that we got in the country at the time, that was kind of nice. So you could live way better than in Finland having the similar type of job. So that was my kind of moment of freedom. Yay! Everything is kind of possible again. And then I just fell into the world of IT. Zeros and ones, baby. There's only on and off. Yes or no. No one, no artistic assholes telling you that, oh, I don't quite like that. Maybe let's do the whole thing again.
Well, how is it? Do you feel pathetic now, you know, having walked away from the field and joining the IT?
No, but there's nothing really glorious in a way about saying that, yeah, hey, I work at service desk. It's just a service desk job. Lowest of the low. Except, yeah, when you get outside of your home country into interesting places like Poland and Philippines and Spain, then there's always the benefit of the environment, of course, you know. I really enjoy the life outside of my country. Maybe it's also an ego thing. I don't know what it is, but also on a daily basis, you just experience such a different world to your own. It's refreshing, and people are more interested about you because you are that weird guy from Finland. What the hell are you doing here? So no, I don't think it's necessarily pathetic. I feel that it's unfortunate that I haven't pushed myself more into projects of the audiovisual sort. I'd love to try that more again. Maybe we'll do something when I get the hell out of here at some point.
Yeah, whenever that will be.
Yeah.
But had you said that you would have felt pathetic, or that you have felt that you were pathetic, like, the reason why I asked the question was that had you said so, I would have extremely heavily pushed against that notion. Because the fact also is that when it comes to like you said, there is nothing glorious in the job you do. Well, I can vouch for the fact that there really is nothing that glorious also in the job in the media field.
Okay.
Like, certainly, yeah, at the end of the day, there is some glory to be had. You can get, as a cinematographer, you can get a really cool shot. As an editor, you can make a really, really smooth flowing edits. There is, like, it's not completely without its glories, but it's nowhere near as glorious as people actually think that it will be when they apply to study the field. Most likely what you are going to land, if you are going to land it, it's either like I said, it's the gig economy, and most likely it will be that for, you know, the rest of your life. Steady jobs are coming ever the more limited on this field. Most likely your gigs are going to be from commercials or from reality TV, the two highest working fields at the moment. You always believe that you are going to work on film. You are going to work especially on feature film, not on short films.
Very few people do that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely limited. And even if you manage to land a feature film gig, it most likely, once again, you are going to be tied with the gig economy. So most likely you are going to get perhaps a 2 or 3 job opportunities working on feature film. And outside of that, then it's reality, and it's commercials, or it's some other TV show. And that's, like, statistically, that is the most likeliest career path that you are going to get. And that is, like, it's not the most glorious avenue in media fields. So the glory really is not that much there either. And when it comes to, like, also, like, staying on the field or lasting on the field, when it comes to, well, hell, even lasting in Finland, nobody can actually say how long you are going to last.
Yeah.
Media field as a field, it's a field that burns you out really quickly because of the way how it's being organized and how it operates.
Yeah.
And in the same way, like, it may also be extremely possible that you have to also venture outside of Finland just in order to land your next gig on the field. So there are no guarantee. There is no need to feel that you didn't last long enough on this field and you abandoned it too quickly. because nobody can actually say how long they have working on media. And hell, nobody can actually say how much they have time to last or work on any given field, at least in Finnish workforce today, because the work culture itself and the idea how, well, in Finland we see work and we see work opportunities, it all goes into more and more gig-based economy in every single field. We no longer, like, when during your parents' or perhaps and your grandparents' time, the way how work operated in Finland, it was like you get a job from a factory or you get a job from a corporation, you get a job from a Nokia. And you can believe that, you know, that job is going to last for you the rest of your lifetime. And perhaps most likely you can also bring your kid into that company or that factory. But that no longer is how work operates in Finland.
And the companies rumoredly would also pay you the flight tickets to the company premises to have the interview or start your first day.
Yeah.
Different kind of culture. The companies would often approach you. Please come work for us.
They did. And there even is rumors, looking back at my parents' and grandparents' days, when the company would even pay you some allowance when you were on holiday, just in order to, you know, make sure that after a holiday ends, you return back to work for that company and you don't change companies. You were really treasured asset back in those days, but these days, you know, it's typical that everyone's work career consists of 5 to 10 to 15 different companies.
Yeah, the Finland is such a ridiculously small country. You'll be kind of lucky, you'll be extremely lucky if you get to do the kind of job that you want to do, looking at the statistics of how many workplaces are currently open in Finland. Like, it's an incredibly small market, and never mind about doing feature films. Even if you would be doing feature films, you know, it's a couple of months project, and then you have to find something else, more less fanciful, and then maybe in a couple of years again you get to do some of those feature films. But yeah, that's, I believe, how it works.
Yeah, I mean, it was just on the news, there were 800 applicants to the Finnish Cinemaplex Finkino.
Yeah.
Just to sell popcorns and movie tickets.
Oh, I saw it.
Like, that's the situation of today. So if somebody doesn't last, I'm not say this just to you, Kari, but, you know, anyone listening in today's episode, especially if you're a media professional or student in Finland, if you don't happen to last on the field, there's no need to actually feel any shame about it. The game is so rigged against you at this point that, you know,
yeah.
If you leave Finland or if you leave the field, like go ahead and do it. Just, you know, do whatever you want and what you can believe that has even the slightest possibilities of making you happy. Because there are no guarantees at all that you will last.
If you want any level of stability in your work, don't choose media. There are a couple of lucky ones that my colleagues who started working at Yle, and they had like a stable jobs working on some funny comedy talk shows and things like that, season after season. So there was always something to do. At the point when I started sleeping at my work office, working on this color grading and assisting editing, just to get shit done, and having this toxic work environment, I guess, then I pretty much didn't have the most positive experience of this field, sadly.
I think that's also the story that I hear basically more and more every single year.
Yeah.
Not necessarily sleeping at your workplace. That might be, like, I haven't heard that many stories of that, of the life of, you know, that ilk yet. But when it comes to toxic work environments, those are coming. You hear reports about that, you know, in increasing frequency.
Yeah. So now that you have had a pretty varied experience in different types of roles, maybe you want to also expand on what kind of roles you've done. But also another question, are you proud of some of the things that you've done? Or do you feel like it was just another job? Or was it something that you gave something good for the society? Not to say that I have given anything very revelatory and amazing by doing service desk in IT, but yeah, what's your experience on that?
I must say I have had surprisingly many of the type of experience where I felt that I've actually finally managed to contribute something to society, and you know, work that I have been able to be proud of myself. I'm one of those people who rarely feels proud about anything that I have done. I usually just do the thing and then I move on to the next one, and I try to pay as a little mind to what I have done in the past as humanly possible. I'm also one of those people who never actually revisits his old work. I don't listen to old Flicklap episodes. I don't watch my old shorts or commercials or basically anything I have done. That's just somehow not in me.
Let's put a little flag there. I think that's really kind of fascinating psychologically. I don't know if there's any way to open up that any further, but there's a lot of actors like that do that too, that I think they never revisit the movies that they were once part of, no matter how famous they got for it, or especially if they got famous. They just can't stand watching themselves, or they just don't care. I actually don't know any high-graded sort of actors that would go back to their material on a regular basis.
I've heard about stories about these actors. I just can't remember who they were. Like, you hear these live stories about actors who liked to watch their past work. And once again, as they got older, when they were really old, they would watch nothing else but their own old films.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember who those actors, or can't remember any of those actors, because at this point, you know, the famous actors, they are kind of just kind of a jelly in your memory. All the names and the faces and the films, they kind of blend in together. It's impossible to say who actually did have this quirk and who did not.
Yeah. Okay. And you've been shooting film. You haven't been acting much, I guess, but you have done some theater work.
Well, like I said, it's gig-based economy, so I do pretty much everything that comes in my way. That has included some directional work, usually commercial films. I haven't done like a TV commercial. I have done commercial short movies. Directing those, some camera work. My latest gig was again being an... I was the second unit cameraman. In that, we were filming the Finnish championship races, snowmobile races for snowmobile enduro. That is like the very last gig that I did. Was taxing as hell.
Okay.
Script writing perhaps is the one that I've done most myself. Like when I try to reminiscent and like count the different type of gigs I've done. Some DIT, that's how I landed feature films originally. But yeah, pretty much just like anything that comes my way. I try to stay away from editing, but I'm not completely alien to the world of editing either, having done some music videos and the sort.
Yeah, there's always positives and negatives to everything, I guess, but... Yeah, I can imagine that shooting has the benefit of you shoot it and you usually, hopefully, don't have any reshoots on that thing, especially if it's kind of reality-based. It's kind of done deal, then you send it to some poor sob in editing booth and they spend days and months on that material that you shot in just a few days.
Yeah. Mostly whenever I do camera work, I try to stay on reality based.
Okay.
Just in order to avoid, you know, the umpteenth reshoot of a scene X.
Mm.
But I have worked as a camera assistant at set in some short movies. So that's also it's not completely alien field to me either, like working as a behind camera in a like production set environment.
Yeah. You know, come to think of it, I had this one project where I was trying to kickstart some kind of my own company doing digitization of old pictures or old films or VHS material. It would have been kind of nice. More kind of technical work. No creativity involved in that sense. But that's something that I've been relatively interested in. Restoring, remastering. Especially after I went through the crazy project it wasn't me who digitized those tapes. But I had like 100 different VHS tapes. And then they were digitized. And I would be heavily involved in that project. Like kind of quality managing it. That everything is going according to plan. Going through different versions of the same material and then comparing, oh, with which VHS player we got the best material. And if there's like mixed results with different players, then we use the computer to combine these materials together to get the best average quality. Yeah, can be kind of fun. But it didn't kick off, so here I am.
Well, you know, when it comes to digitally editing and re-enhancing, transforming old materials, I never saw the whole Wignut Films' Beatles documentary, The Get Back. I believe it was named The Beatles Get Back. Anyways, came from the same company that made the World War One documentary, They Shall Never Grow Old. And you know, looking back at those two projects and at times extremely horrendous quality that those films had, I gotta say that you perhaps didn't miss all that much.
Right. Yeah, it's not always good if it's old.
No, and I can say that, you know, AI effects these days, they make a hell of a job. Like it sounds like a smart idea. You know, use AI to fix, for example, old film material and to enhance film material.
Don't even get me started.
It sounds like a novel. It sounds like a really like a winner choice. And then you see the end results, especially if you see the end results from a big screen. You're like, oh my god.
Yeah, this is one of those like pioneering moments or something. Like in the past, we had this phase where we had really shit quality digital video. The beginning phases of YouTube, for example, unfortunately, we're going to suffer from these After Effects for years now. People have spent a lot of time digitizing their collections in this shit quality phase of the internet. Everything got downgraded horribly in the beginning few years of YouTube, for example. And everything started to be more online, and especially streaming. So it was a horrible downgrade in the quality from the original digital masters, let's say. And the thing is that, well, a lot of that material is now shit quality and just have to wait that somebody's going to find the original sources again and then get the quality back to the par that it was supposed to be. And now this AI digitalization, call it what you want. Oh boy, we're just kind of manipulating old material to something that it wasn't, it couldn't be, it never was. Adding information to those tapes that wasn't there, making them look all sorts of weird. And that's going to be saved for the new generations of people.
Yeah, the saddest part there is that, like, I would be more okay with that if the input then would be also better quality. Like, for example, like, They Shall Never Grow Old. And the big deal there was, or the big marketing push behind that film originally was that they are going to color the old black and white footage.
Mm.
And when it comes to coloring black and white footage, that's nothing new. People have done that for decades. They, back in the old days, they used to do that even by hand.
Just yeah.
painting color on top of, you know, black and white film grain. But, like, so in itself, the stunt itself is not groundbreaking and it's not new. It's, you do something that people have been doing for quite some time now. And then even after that, like, you decided to use AI digital effects, and all of a sudden the end result is weaker than what it was back in those older films that did the exact same stunt.
Mm-hmm.
So you have more advanced technology that you used to do the old gimmick, and the end result is actually lesser than what it has been before. And that's what really kind of pushes my buttons when it comes to that topic.
Yeah, now the trend is that gotta have HD, the higher the better. I'm not completely writing off the whole AIing of video, but there's a long way to go before we get to something that is would be kind of broadcast acceptable. I've been doing some minor tests on some of my material, how that SD material from Video 8 would look like in HD. Yeah, terrible. I guess if you would use the smallest settings to add like detail to the picture, it would give some kind of nice sharpening effect to that, but I would say no, not at this point. Let's wait another 10, 20 years.
Yeah, I would also make a hard pass. I'm also less of a believer when it comes to, you know, 10 or 15 years. Like, in my opinion, there are material like that shouldn't necessarily be given the HD treatment. Simply already on the basis on how it was originally shot.
Like when
you were shooting the footage on the lesser equipment, and therefore you had the lesser visual effect on the material that you were shot. Well, a capable cinematographer, a semi-smart director, then works around that subject matter, makes certain that the film is shot in a way that is not necessarily a, you know, groundbreaking problem. Which then, if you come 5 years later and you just digitally enhance it in HD, there is no any guarantees that the film itself wouldn't suffer in the process, because it was originally planned and shot, and all around it was produced the way that it was produced around the limits and the hardships that the technology of that day and age provided, and you worked around it. The whole thing was thought from the perspective of, okay, these are the limits, how we are going to circumvent them. And if you now just kind of just uplift it into the HD quality, there is, in my opinion, enhanced possibility that, you know, something that was not originally or film that was planned in a certain way, it will turn out to be in another way now that it's HD.
Yeah.
Like to give an actual like grounded example of this, harkening back to the very old episode of the Flick Lab, where we were going through the old Halloween movies. Now some of those have gotten the image has been made more clear. There has been the not necessarily being brought back to HD, but more and more, you know, the image has been upscaled.
Yeah.
At least to some effect. And all of a sudden, you may start to actually notice some inconsistencies and small errors in the footage.
Mm-hmm.
You can see a crew member A there. You can see a speck of a film camera in the left corner. You can see a reflection on some surface, etc., etc., etc. And that originally, like, wasn't necessarily a problem there, and those may be things that the filmmakers didn't account for, because the original filming equipment wasn't on the level, or the projection equipment wasn't on the level that they had to actually worry about such things. But now that you come 10 to 15 years later and you digitally enhance the image, make it more clearer, the original quote-unquote mistakes that exist there simply because, you know, it weren't problems back in the day and they were filming around the problems and the limitations that they had when the film was originally shot. But now they start to creep up. And now they start to be a problem for the film itself.
Yeah, you can see that, for example, in some of the early major CGI blockbusters. Take Jurassic Park, perhaps. You watch that on 4K UHD disc. And yeah, now you have the crystal clear, real shot footage. And then you see The groundbreaking CGI, which looks quite blurry.
Which you remember, it was really something breathtaking when you saw it originally.
I don't know, maybe they had the same problem when the film was shot in cinemas to an extent. But yeah, when it comes to home video, it's a different story.
I honestly don't remember having that effect. Okay, once again, I was a little kid when I saw Jurassic Park for the first time. So, you know, simply the pleasure of seeing an image that moves may have, of course, you know, affected my experience. But I could swear that those dinosaurs didn't look as honky as they do now in digitally enhanced.
Yeah.
Version than what, you know, back in the old days.
The film grain probably protected a little bit of those CGI assets on screen.
I'm 100% certain that it did.
Mm-hmm.
It gave them some blendability
into
the film itself. And I'm like doubly as strong on this point when it comes to AI enhancing the film material, where it becomes more and more like the programs simply just guessing and putting frames on the film stock and just like through a guesswork adding pixels into the picture.
Yeah, that's one thing. But
yeah,
one thing that I might be really excited about is artificially doubling the frame count in films. I think this is going to be some kind of a trend in the near future. People are just not quite there yet for some reason. I mean, we play all kinds of games with 120 hertz monitors, and you have like, I have 100 frames per second running here, and everything else is just garbage. So why don't we think about the same things in movies? It's interesting. I think it's going to be a thing. And that can be easily manufactured. You have a 24 frames per second movie. You can multiply that. Well, you can double it easily to 48 frames per second. And you wouldn't notice any difference that it's actually created by the computer. Counting just an additional frame. Figuring out what the frame would be based on the frame that you're in and the next actual frame.
Yeah, I can believe that you couldn't necessarily guess that it has been done by a computer when it comes to, you know, in case of adding more frames. Where I'm more hesitant is in the overall effect that would have on the film or your experience with the film. But the first example of this that comes to mind would be those Hobbit movies that were shot, was it twice the frame rate?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and well, it didn't bother me personally, but I have, you know, met more and more people who have reported that effect made them physically ill. Sometimes to a point where they had to actually walk out of the theater and in mid movie, simply because they just couldn't watch it to the end because they were just too quick. Too many frames. The movement was somehow too fast-paced. The other that people have been complaining, once again, was not my personal experience, but what I've heard is that with that effect, with those added frame rates, the film started to feel unreal to them.
Yeah, that's I've heard that before, but it could be just in juxtaposition to what they've used to watching.
It could be, but once again, that would be like when we are thinking from the audience experience. If it's just, you know, adjusting into what you are used to, well, the advent of those towards the frame rate movies would also mean that the audiences at large would have to kind of get adjusted into this new, more fast-paced, more quickly moving film. And that's kind of a heavy demand for the audiences at large, in the point when you are demanding that from them simply because, well, the industry at large decided that since it's a fun gimmick, the movies would need to have more frames. Because nobody actually, when it comes to Hobbit movies, nobody was actually, you know, writing Peter Jackson emails demanding that there would have to be more frames in the film. Just that, you know, the production company decided, and Jackson decided that, hell yeah, we're going to film these films in you know, higher frame. And they, mostly it was decided just so, because it worked as a gimmick for those movies. It was purposely really, you know, made press statements about the fact that higher frame rate, more frames. So it was nothing else. It was just a gimmick. And then we have audiences at large who are not adjusted to watch a film of that pace. So it's kind of a heavy demand at the end.
And at the same time, it's so weird. At the same time, you have the gamers who 20 years ago, they didn't give a crap about frame rates, and barely people even knew what the frame rate is. And now people are all crazy about frame rates. Gotta have at least 100 frames per second, when we were just fine with 15 frames per second in some cases.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, you know. when it comes to video games, I can meet the argument halfway. I can see that, you know, games themselves have, of course, changed when it comes to what type of games we play. Back in the 15 frame days, it was mostly side scrollers. These days, you know, it's third person action games. It's the first person Twitch shooters, and in some of those games, I can actually see that, you know, the FPS count actually does matter to a point.
Yeah.
If you play Call of Duty Twitch shooter, in that case, you know, playing it with 15 frames, that's going to be a problem. Or if you play something 3D action RPG, highly punishing, like, let's say, you know, From Software game. There, the lower frame rate actually can really hurt you, because if it dips at any point, you may take an, you know, a hit that you would have otherwise been able to avoid, and in a highly punishing game, you know, that might be just the limit between life and death. Right. For your character, that is. But outside of that argument, mostly I feel that, you know, when it comes to the FPS count in video games, it's just more and more, and this is my personal opinion, but it's just more and more, just, you know, kind of a technical vanity and nothing else. Like, I can see that the FPS count, it matters up to perhaps 60 FPS, depending on the game that you are playing. Call of Duty Twitch shooter, 60 FPS may be something that, like, in a Call of Duty Twitch shooter, that 60 FPS, it may be have gameplay affecting effect. But it does not apply to any game, and I would say that there also the cap would be somewhere in 60, perhaps even lower. To be absolutely honest, perhaps even in 50 FPS. When it comes to 100 and 120 etc. FPS, in there I'm more and more, I just believe that that's just, you know, technical wanker. You put thousands of dollars into your rig, you pay $4,000 for you know, your video card, and $2,000 for the motherboard, etc., etc. After all that monetary investment, you have to actually believe and be able to tell others, and especially to yourself, that that money was not wasted. So you tell everybody that, no, you absolutely have to have 150 FPS or the game feels broken.
Yeah.
Then again, you know, look back at FromSoft. Bloodborne was capped at 30 and didn't even manage to keep that consistent on PS4. Sometimes dipped into 15 frames per second. And okay, yeah, 15 frames per second. When the game was running at 15, that was actually a problem. That did have a possibility of leading into you taking involuntary hits from the enemies, and Bloodborne was highly punishing video game, so, you know, there it might actually matter. But still, the game itself was capped at 30, and it was Game of the Year in God knows how many places.
Yep.
Won countless awards. Was audience-beloved game, considered classic even today. Even after Elden Ring, many people consider Bloodborne to be FromSoft's one of the best, if not even the best game. Possibly even better than what is Elden Ring. So in that sense, you know, I do find you has to have 120 FPS, kind of a honky demand.
Yeah.
People loved capped at 30.
Yeah, I do remember that. Also, in video games, you don't have the problem that you have with movies in terms of improving the visual quality. Take, for example, this different game remasterings, which is a big thing lately, making more bucks with just a little simple facelift with some of the classics out there, or just bundling them together with some small extra features. Lately, I've been playing Tomb Raider Remaster with the parts 1, 2, 3. And now you can play Tomb Raider on 60 frames per second. Just simply buy the remaster on Steam and off you go. Without any patching and all that nonsense.
Finally makes that T-Rex boss battle in Tomb Raider 1 beatable, am I right?
Makes it a little bit scarier, I guess. Looks like more like a jungle. But anyway, yeah. What about on tech side? Still anything you want to say about the different video editing software or other software or operating systems that you've used over the years?
Not that much, no. In the end, I haven't used that many different softwares. Mostly just Premiere or Resolve.
Right.
I lean more into Resolve, but everyone else wants to use Premiere for some god awful reason that I've never actually been able to understand why. I did try some of those other softwares like HitFilm and what have you, but I don't know. I quite quickly just walked away from those.
Mm. Well, like I said before, I used some of the earliest stable versions of Premiere. Well, you know, Premiere existed like 10 years before I touched Premiere, but that was supposed to be some kind of stable version around 2001, 2002. So I did that. Kind of shortly after that, a couple of years later, I jumped into the Linux bandwagon. The thing at the time with Linux was that it was not ready for prime time with audiovisual stuff, especially video editing back in those days. Like the same software was available by name at that point, like Kden Live and OpenShot, maybe? I used Kden Live. It kept crashing like a motherfucker. That was basically unusable during those days. If you had something serious to work with, you know, forget it. Not gonna work out. Except maybe if you were using some FFmpeg scripts and commands to do more simple streamlined command line type of video editing and compressing and converting. I think that would be just fine, but yeah, we needed to wait for quite a while before we got anything serious going on Linux video editing space. And that's unfortunately largely why I left Linux at that time, and that's when Macintosh was the hot shit, and I jumped on that thing, and everyone at work and at school in the video field were using Macs, so that was kind of a no-brainer to then use Macs for compatibility and just ease of use, and less crashes than on Windows at that time, for sure. So that was all well and good, but then there comes a point where you just see the shortcomings of commercial operating systems. You feel the how they try to make them unusable, the operating systems, as the years go by, so that people would buy more computers, of course. So that's where I started switching my things back to Linux, just to see where we stand right now. And to my surprise, that the basic operations with video editing, let's say like 5 years ago and now, it's okay. It works. And one big thing that happened in Linux space was the DaVinci Resolve, yeah, that gained its Linux version at some point. And you can buy the pro version of that. And as far as I know, when you do that and install a couple of funny things, then you have a Mac or Windows level editing space on your system. So that's great. Haven't bought it. I've been just doing fine with the open source Kden Live so far, for all the simple things that I do, like the YouTube videos for the Flick Lab, you know, pretty much as simple as it gets. But yeah, waiting for my first crashes when I launch up 25 different timelines or video tracks on the same project and go watch it crash and burn.
Yeah, the industry is kind of... Enthusiasm to use Macs is one of the things that I've never actually understood, at least when it comes to film in Finland.
I think it's like more historical reasons. People got used to that when Mac was the king of multimedia, but that's not really the case anymore. You can do largely the same things as well with Windows or Linux.
Could be. I kind of missed the... I missed the early days when you know, Mac was, or when Mac made the push in audiovisual and video and editing space. So of course, when it comes to any nostalgic factors working on Mac, I completely missed those and therefore don't have them. But looking at the situation as an outsider, I can kind of understand the appeal of the Mac, since they are, in my opinion, still more stable than what Windows is. The only way to actually resolve a problem in a Windows is with a shotgun. Yeah. That damn thing, the thing likes, it always likes to break something down. And usually it's something really small and extremely obscure, but it just somehow manages to fuck up the entire workstation.
Yeah, it was my understanding that the new Windows versions are not... Microsoft doesn't have like a proper testing department anymore for anything. It's more like, let's just push out this version and see what people think and then push the fixes.
That would explain so many things past Windows 7, in my opinion.
Yeah, and when you compare that to the, as it appears, simplicity of Mac, where it's just kind of drag and drop an application to a folder and, oh boy, it's installed already. Type of simplicity, I see why people would gravitate towards it. However, like with something as complex as video editing, there's things about codecs. You need a certain level of flexibility with your operating system, goddammit, on occasion to do some more advanced things. And if your operating system is not kind of willing to quite bend that way, like installing some libraries and codecs and stuff like that, like it can be the pain point with Mac, then yeah, you might run with the tail between your legs to Windows.
Yeah, that, and the another big problem that I have with Mac is that as an infrastructure, it's so closed.
Yeah.
When it comes to like, you need iPaper in order to take iShit in iToilet. If you are working in Mac environment.
Absolutely.
And that's like the losing of that flexibility that you can still have with Windows. even though Windows itself, it is honky and it's like it breaks down in any given Sunday, but still losing that flexibility, I am surprised that the media field at large is still so hooked up with Mac. At this point, I actually believe that media professionals are like the largest customer base that Mac anymore, or Apple at this point anymore, has. Everybody else has abandoned Apple, but thank God there are the media professionals who still are dead end sticking with it.
Yeah, it's goddamn nonsense these days, I would say. Mac OS, often considered tightly knit with the hardware that it comes with. Yeah, that may be the case, that it flows like buttery smooth when you buy it. Wait a couple of years, though, and something will happen. It will become fucking unusable. At that point, you know, you go somewhere else, or you are not the smartest, you know, consumer, and you just buy the next Mac thing.
Yeah, well, with Mac, there's a really limited amount of like small repairs that you can actually do in Mac environment.
That as well.
If something breaks down, so it very quickly becomes the question of you either buying a new Mac or you just walking away from Apple at altogether.
Right, and then you mentioned the iSheet and iToilet and those valuable things like that. Once you get out of the iEcosystem inside Mac, you're on your own. And oh my God, if you try to export your settings or your documents or something out of the iSheet, it's quite complicated. Same goes for Microsoft, by the way, and their Office. Mm-hmm. Take OneNote, for example. You might have like thousands of separate pages on OneNote. Then one day you decide, okay, I don't want to do it the Microsoft way anymore. Okay, good luck. I think your options are basically manually export each and every page one by one to a Microsoft document, like a Word document, and then copy paste to some other application.
Yeah, pretty much. That's the main reason why I try to avoid using OneNote or any of those, especially any of Microsoft cloud-based work environments as largely as possible. Like when it comes to, for example, Office programs, I would rather use something like Microsoft Office 2007. than any cloud-based application that Microsoft offers to me.
Yeah, cloud is all it's about. I keep dealing with Microsoft Office on a day-to-day basis in my work, solving the different issues with Outlook and Word and Excel and plugins and like that software is made by a bunch of evil maniacs. The years and years of development of adding patch over patch over patch and new feature that people request, one here, other there, all the menus confusingly built, a bunch of mess, the whole code base now so bloated that opening your email application takes, I don't know, 30 seconds to a minute or more. Just forget about using like old HDD. Disks. It's just gonna take maybe 5 minutes. It's just complete bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah, and also on top of that, I just can't like stand the visual UI design in the new Microsoft applications. Like the Windows 11, and it's just a matter of taste, but to me it looks absolutely horrendous, and I hate the way how it looks. I absolutely was appalled by Windows 8 and that like tap screen style that inherited. That was like that was the worst graphical user interface that Microsoft has or anyone has ever pulled off. And I was really happy that Windows 10 abandoned that, even though Windows 10 still looked, in my opinion, kind of like hot garbage. But oh boy, Windows 11. Like, Jesus Christ, please design that again graphically.
Yeah, it's just Microsoft has this weird tendency of trying out the latest hot shit and then making it and baking it into the operating system as something really integral that everybody has to use. And then, I don't know, couple of months, 6 months, a year goes by, and then they're like, maybe this didn't work out. It's nice that we tried it, though, and let's just go back to where we were. I think in many ways operating systems are now at the stage where, you know, all the basic functionality, it's fine. You don't need to improve it much anymore. It's done. But as a company, you always constantly have to innovate, and it leads to shit shows like Windows 11.
Yeah, well, there was a time when actually they didn't feel the need to constantly evolve the user system. So if memory serves correct, was it Windows 7 or was it Windows 10 that at the time was reported to be the last Windows operating system that Microsoft ever puts out? Okay, it was, and if I remember correctly, it was Windows 7. Like, Microsoft gave a sworn oath that this is the last Windows that we will release. After this, it's just going to be, you know, updates and patchwork on this system, but there will not be a new Windows.
Yeah, I think it was Windows 10. Model.
Yeah, could have been Windows 10. But anyways, here we are, Windows 11. Yeah. It's desperately trying to be, like, forcefully pushed down to your throats. And you actually have to, like, take your own separate steps and physically start to block Windows 10 from updating itself automatically to Windows 11. Which also is some grand level bullshit that I just can't completely comprehend.
Yeah, working day to day on my work with Windows 10, I just feel sorry for humanity that you people have to put up with this bullshit. Everything is like in a John Woo movie in slow motion. Anyway, for the last few years, I've been just working exclusively with Linux. And now lately, just been sticking to Debian. Debian has this philosophy of staying as solid as a rock. Just selecting the most stable current versions of applications that are available and kind of testing it to death and then pushing out the new version. Then for the next 2 years or so, they will just push out the security updates. And if there's something like that absolutely needs to be updated, like feature-wise, they will probably push it, but the absolute focus is on security updates. So nothing will break, at least for those 2 years. And the updates should be smooth. I usually just, you know, start from the ground again. I just wipe out everything and install the new system from scratch. But that's just me. And when it comes to the Flick Lab, though, it has also given a lot, I think. I think we sometimes fail to appreciate the things it has given to us. At least for me, I think about this phenomenon called the prodigy effect, which means that we can retain information better and faster when we know we have to teach it for others later, mainly for the audience here, I guess. So that's definitely where DFL shines for me. At the very least, if we're talking in kind of purely selfish terms, that works for me. And I have learned quite a bit about history and sciences here, and of course, movies, and something about movie making while doing this podcast. So that has been a great journey.
Yeah, as Finns, we love nothing as much as to complain about everything and cursing whatever it is that we are currently doing. But to me also, the lab has been, in the end, to be absolutely honest, quite a positive experience.
Okay, yeah. Even surprised in this episode how much you are feeling positive about the Flick Lab.
I don't know. I usually, honestly, outside of just, you know, your typical downgrading Finnish jokiness aside, I really don't have that much, or haven't had that much against the lab itself in any of the past episodes.
Yeah.
Of course, since you make this almost year round, take away, you know, a couple of breaks that we have, there may be an individual episode where you, that the world is crushing you down at the moment of the recording, or there, or you just feel the fatigue at that point. So there might be an episode here, another there, where I'm not perhaps the most joyful myself, but typically, like I would say, like 90% of time, I'm actually pretty happy to be doing the lab.
That's nice. I guess that's why we are still here almost 6 years later.
Well, it most definitely it's not the money and naked chicks that we get out of this gig.
Not many of those. To be completely honest, this season and the last couple of seasons, it's been increasingly hard to figure out what to do next. Where do we want to take this? What kind of movies do we really want to watch? Or are we just watching for the sake of watching? Or what's gonna be the thing? But heck, we try to deliver this season as well. Don't know what's gonna be next in this podcast. The next episode even.
I guess we see that in the fortnight.
Until then.
Okei, sammutan nauhoituksen. Hienosti 2 tuntia välttäisi ihan totaalisesti sitä, että me itse asiassa sukelletaan Terminaattori 2X, mutta täytyy onnitella sua suorituksesta.